Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Be of good courage, and he will strengthen thine heart. Our Father, thou knowest that we love thee, and that the highest aspiration of our souls is to serve thee. Deliver us, we pray, from the perils of pride and despair. Enable us by thy Spirit to walk in the path of righteousness and truth, and to pray for peace on earth, remembering that thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. This 10th year in the life of this school has brought us rich blessings. We are very happy to have in the series of guest speakers Miss Alma Faye Hunt. Miss Hunt is a native of Virginia. She earned the BS degree at Virginia State Teachers College and the Master of Arts degree at Columbia University, and was awarded the Doctor of Humane Letters degree by William Jewell College. She has participated as a teacher and as an administrator in public education in the state of Virginia. She has served as Dean of Women of William Jewell College, and since 1948, she has been Executive Secretary of the Woman's Missionary Union of the Southern Baptist Convention. Those of us who have had the joy of fellowship with her in service remember always three things about her. Her mind has been sharpened and shaped by exposure to Christian truth. Her sense of mission has been fortified by faithful work in the task to which she is committed. And amidst the exacting demands of leadership in an enormous undertaking, she manifests the qualities of integrity, interpersonal competence, and a high degree of what St. John of the Cross called tranquility, gentleness, and strength. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. It's a privilege to welcome Dr. Hunt and to present her to you.
Dr. Binkley, certainly I am grateful for that generous introduction. It is one that I shall try to hold in my mind and heart and work toward being worthy of by the end of my day. I was amazed when Dr. Binkley said this is the 10th year of this seminary, to realize that all of these years have passed and I have never before been privileged to be here. Now, I want to say that I have been invited, but at times when I could not come. And so this year, as you began your school year, I thought I must, at some time during the year, see Southeastern Seminary. I wanted to have touch with life on the campus here. And in a meeting in Nashville, Tennessee, I met Dr. Staley, and he was talking with a friend of his, a man I did not know. And so I went by and said, "When are you going to invite me to Southeastern Seminary?" Well, he declared that the letter was in the mail. And when I got back to Birmingham, sure enough, it was. And so we had a bit of correspondence back and forth, my trying to decide whether or not the letter had been written before I invited myself. And so I said to Dr. Staley's friend, "If you ever read in the press that I have been to Southeastern Seminary, you may be sure that it's on my own invitation. I'm trying to get invited up there." Well, imagine my surprise when I arrived here last night to find that Dr. Staley had fled. And of course, I have to spend the rest of the day writing a note to him, just what I think of his absence today. But I'm sure he's off cooperating. In one of our meetings that we had been long with together in conference on the convention of the convention heads of agencies, and someone said to us, "Now we just must have time to understand and cooperate in this matter." And Dr. Staley said, "I am cooperating so much, I'm not having any time to operate." So I am sure he's off cooperating while I am here hoping to see him operating. But surely it is a joy to at last have touch with your life here on the campus. As I walked in here this morning, I almost felt that I was by myself. There's such a gulf between where we were sitting back here and where you are sitting. And then I realized that you are perhaps typical of Baptists, for Baptists never come forward in a meeting, but always sit way in the back. But I hope that you men who are preparing yourselves to be preachers will realize someday just how it feels to have all these vacant seats at the front when you rise up to preach. But I'm sure that'll be too late for you ever to occupy the front seats and help somebody out while I'm screaming back there to you on the back. And the next generation of students who come here will no doubt occupy the back seats also. But even sitting where you are, where I can hardly see you, I am delighted to be here with you. Now, you may be expecting me to talk about Women's Missionary Union, and I am not. I would like very much to have accepted the invitation which came earlier to be here for a period of days and to meet with you in some class sessions when we could talk about the purposes of the organization that I represent. I would like for you men particularly to know it so that as you go out into your pastorates or into the positions you will hold as ministers of music, of education, that you would be able to lend the greatest help in what we believe a vital part of the life of our denomination. But today I would prefer spending the time that I have with you talking about not an organization, but what we as an organization and you as Baptist ministers or ministers of education or leaders in our denomination, in whatever capacity you find yourself, are working toward. That task of world evangelization. In 1959, Mrs. Mathis, who is the president of Women's Missionary Union, and I were privileged to visit the mission fields in the Orient and Africa. We were invited to go by the Foreign Mission Board. After 18 months of trying to decide when we could be out of the country and away from our tasks long enough to do it, we decided to leave from the convention which met in Louisville and go for a 4 month period following that. Now, the Foreign Mission Board did not send us just on a journey to see the world, but sent us out to do what we could do in those mission fields and to gain knowledge of them, which would help us to do our task here. And so when the time had been set, Dr. Cawthon and the area secretaries at the board wrote out to the men who are the chairman, the elected chairman of the missions in these 24 countries, and asked them to make preparations for what should, and plans for what should be done with us during the time that we were there. Now, when I knew this plan, I knew that they would probably kill us, because if you know missionaries, and there's some of them here on your campus, you know that there's much in their countries that they want you to see, and of course there were opportunities that they wanted us to take advantage of. And so I could just see us traveling by night so that we could be in meetings by day, and sure enough, that's just about what happened to us. But the Foreign Mission Board divided up this time. If we could have 4 months, we should spend 10 days in Japan and 4 days in Korea and 6 days in Hong Kong and 6 days in Taiwan. For those men there at the board knew how much work there was to see, and therefore they could help with the allotment of time. When that had been decided, then the Foreign Mission Board wrote out to these men and said we would arrive on such and such a day and depart on such and such a day, and they were to make the plans. Well, we did nothing about it except to leave it in their hands, and we left when the convention was over in Louisville. Out to Seattle we went and flew across the Pacific directly to Tokyo, making only one stop in the Aleutians for fuel. Now, we left on a Saturday night at 10 o'clock, and we arrived 17 hours later in Tokyo, and it was Monday morning, so we had already lost Sunday in crossing the ocean. Never did figure just exactly what happened to that date, for I never have really understood the international date line. But I took them at their word that this was Monday morning. When we got off the plane, it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'd already been up 8 hours. And shortly thereafter, the missionaries took us to a hotel to eat, and I didn't know whether to order breakfast, lunch, or dinner. I just didn't know where I stood in this day, for it was already time for the evening meal, as far as my day was concerned. But that day stretched on to a 22-hour day before the people who lived there were ready to retire and offered us the benefit of a bed. And on the next morning, we went to our first meeting in the Orient. Now, I had studied all my life, as you have, about the customs of the Orient and the people there, and I should have been thoroughly prepared for these days in the Orient. But somehow, in the busyness of getting ready, I had never stopped to even think about what I knew about this part of the world. And so on that morning, it was cold in Japan, and I put on the one heavy dress I had. Now, when you travel around the world, you can't carry very much luggage on those national airlines, and so luggage was a problem, how many clothes you could take for hot weather, cold weather, wet weather, dry weather. And so I had only one dress for the cold weather, and this being a black dress. I put this on that morning, and the flat shoes that I had bought for traveling, you know, the tourist type of thing, with a strap that buckled them securely on my foot. And then I went out to have my first experience in a church in Japan. Well, when I got there, I saw what I should have expected but had forgotten. Right inside, a tiny little foyer and a row of shoes there. Everybody had deposited the shoes there. Well, here I was, the American tourist, with shoes buckled securely on my foot so that I couldn't step out in a graceful Japanese way, but rather had to bend down, unbuckle the shoes, and step out. When I stepped up this little step there, I couldn't do it as the Japanese do without aid, but I reached out to hold on to somebody while I stepped up and at the same time slipped my foot into those shoes the church furnished. Now, these shoes looked like the men's bedroom slippers, the kind you men wear with just a toe in and no heel slides. And they're about the size you would wear, a bit large for a woman. And so as we started down the aisle, we did not walk by lifting up the foot as we are accustomed to, but rather slid down the aisle just like this. And I looked at that aisle, and I thought that was the slickest aisle I had ever seen in my life. For remember, it's never had the touch of a woman's heel or the shoe heels that you men wear on your shoes. Always it has been polished by these shoes which the church furnishes. When we got to the front, the front pew was close to the platform, and there was a piano there with a very sharp corner. And then on the other side, just on the side of the platform, there was a beautiful Japanese arrangement of flowers. The Japanese are the most artistic people in all the world. They can take two or three little branches of cherry blossoms or something and make a thing of beauty of it. And so here was this fragile, beautiful thing going out over these little steps, four of them, leading up to the platform. And I began to contemplate those steps and wonder how I was going up those slick steps with those big shoes on between that piano and that arrangement of flowers and not knock either the piano over or the arrangement of flowers. But the time came and the awkward performance was gone through, and then we were on the platform to make our first speeches through interpreters. Now that is no fun, this thing of everything you have to say, you slow up enough for an interpreter to catch it and give it to the people who are there. And after we'd finished this morning session, the minister's wife said that the room had been prepared for us to rest in. Now, at this point, we weren't tired, but nevertheless, if rest was the order of the day, we thought we should take advantage of it. And so we were led into the room, which was a part of the church building where the pastor and his wife live. And there we saw what I should have expected, but what I had forgotten to expect, that there were no beds in this bedroom, but rather two things that you and I would call pallets, two little things down on the floor, made up on the floor, on this tatami floor. Now, the tatami floor itself is a type of straw and is rather soft, and the bed was no more than a thick comfort on that with another comfort on top, a comfort with a contour sheet upside down on it so that you saw all the crochet and the fancy work on the top of this so-called contour sheet that covered this top comfort. Well, laughingly, we crawled not up into bed, but down into bed, and spent a few minutes in rest. And then we were taken into the church dining room for our lunch and meal. Now, all of you have eaten in the church dining rooms, and you know what you expect when you are going to walk into a church dining room. Well, when we walked into this one, it was quite different. The women had already gathered, and we found their little tables about so high, and all the women kneeling around these tables, many of them wearing the Japanese kimonos. And so here came the time for us to try this. Now, you who have known the American way of life, as I have, and have sat in chairs since you were children, ought to go home and try to sit Japanese style and just see how you get along. For we sat on our knees, feet together, toes turned under, and you sit back on your heels. You can do it well 1 minute, in second minute you're suffering, in the third minute you're just in agony. And here we were, sitting in this horrible position with chopsticks before us and a meal we had never seen anything like before. Well, I didn't know how I was going to endure this first meal or those that were to follow in this position. But Mrs. Mathis was much more alert that morning than I, for quickly she decided that she needed a picture of this to take back home and show the folks at home. And so she got up from this position and paraded up and down the dining room taking pictures the whole time and never did kneel down and try to eat with those chopsticks or sit in that position. And thus in that first meeting, she discovered a pattern which she followed at all times when things were awkward. Whenever we got in an awkward situation, she wanted a picture of it to take back home. And so she did not have to do the suffering that I did. She carried that pattern with her as we went into Africa. We had been told that in Africa, if we were accepted by the people, we would be given gifts, live gifts at times. And I shall never forget the day we were standing in the yard of the home of an African minister. We'd been talking with his wife. She was telling us that he was not there. He'd be back in a short time. And then she just suddenly disappeared. And I turned to the missionary who was with us, and I said, "Where'd she go?" "Oh," he said, "perhaps to get you a gift." And so when she came out from behind the house, she had a black chicken flopping, and Mrs. Mathis immediately decided that she would like a picture of this to take back home. So I received this flopping chicken, and she took the picture of it, a picture I have never seen. And so I received all the other live things that came our way whenever they were presented to us. That experience in the Japanese church was just the beginning of experiences that were different and interesting. In most of the churches that we went there, the custom was just as I have described to you in this first one. And then we went over to Korea next and thought we were well prepared for the customs of the Orient. And so by the time I approached the first Korean church, I had no difficulty in just stepping right out of my shoes, ready to step into those the church would furnish. But lo, the church didn't furnish any there. For in those churches, you go into the church in your stocking feet. And these floors were even slicker than the others, for they've been polished with stocking feet or sock feet all of these years. And the church was very different in that it had no pews in it. This church, or these churches, were just plain, big, bare rooms with slick floors. We came down to the front just as though there had been pews and sat down as one would sit when going to speak to a meeting right on the front. But instead of sitting in a pew, we sat flat on the floor. Now, the Korean people do not sit as the Japanese people do on their heels. They just sit. And the Korean women are very lovely, for they have great, big, full skirts, these long, beautiful skirts that are a part of the Japanese woman's dress. Well, it's quite different for us to sit there in the American tourist dress down on the floor. But the hard time came when we were presented to speak. Now, just imagine yourself sitting flat on the floor, and the audience is on the floor with you, and you're presented by the pastor to speak, and you have to come forward. There was nothing to hold on to, no chair to pull up by, nobody to help you up. There you were, just sitting in the floor, having to rise and go forward to speak. Well, never once did I ever get myself up, however awkward this performance was, that I didn't find at least 1 foot asleep, for you and I are not accustomed to sitting on our feet, you see. And so I would go stumbling forward to get to the front of the church in which to speak to the people. Well, I can laugh and think about that experience, and yet I cannot think of them without, apart from the wonderful experiences of Christian fellowship which I had with Korean Baptist people. Nowhere except in Africa, I suppose in all the world, do people sing as wonderfully as the Korean people sing. They know their hymns from memory. There was no passing out of the hymn books, no even announcing of the numbers ordinarily, but just the beginning of the singing of a hymn, and all of them came right in to join in with it. Well, the experiences continued on and on. I think one that I shall remember longest happened to us in the southern part of the Philippines when we were there being introduced again. It was a church way south. The people had come. They were rather the peasant type of people. They had come, the women in their peasant dresses, not the typical Filipino costume that you see in pictures, but the peasant type of dress. And they were brought in some sort of little carts that were more like, I suppose, the old surrey that we used to have in the States. The thing opened in the back, and the people stepped down a couple of steps and got out. And it was a picturesque sight to see them arrive for this afternoon missionary meeting. We were being introduced by a missionary who had not mastered the language, and he was speaking through an interpreter. And he said the first speaker today will be Mrs. Mathis, who is the president of the Women's Missionary Union. Now, after you've spoken through interpreters a while, you come to learn how long it takes a person in the language to say what you've just said. And so this interpreter seemed to get along very well in interpreting that. And then the missionary said, and after Mrs. Mathis has spoken, Miss Hunt, the executive secretary of the Women's Missionary Union, will speak. And the interpreter started, and he went on and on and on. And I knew that he had gone beyond the time it should have taken him to say what had been said to him. So I leaned over to the missionary next to me, and I said, what's he doing? She said, he's having some trouble. Well, I couldn't imagine what kind of trouble. And finally, when he finished his statement, and everyone laughed a bit, I said to her, what was his trouble? Well, she said, he was having an awful time explaining about you. And suddenly I realized that an unmarried woman of my age in that part of the world was just an unheard of oddity. And this man was trying to put over the meaning of the word miss. And so finally, in order to make the people understand, he said, Miss Hunt is still negotiable. So I left there with a spry step, knowing that the man had so introduced me. Well, these experiences could go on and on around the world. And yet today, as I thought of coming here, I thought I would like most of all to think with you about the seminary education, the education of ministers, as I saw it in various parts of the world. For those people who are studying in the institutions abroad, are kinsfolk of yours. They have the same purposes in mind. They have heard the same call of God. They are preparing themselves with whatever facilities are available to do the thing in their countries that you have been called to do here or abroad. And so I thought you would be interested in them, in their possibilities for preparation, for life service, and in just what I observed of seminary education. I would want to say to you that I cannot see any hope for the salvation of the world apart from seminary education. There is nothing more important being done in the world today than the thing that you are benefiting by here. I shall depart just a minute from this thought to help you to see why I have come to this conclusion. While in Hong Kong, I was taken by a medical doctor and his wife down into the section of Hong Kong where the refugees live. These people who've escaped from communist China, who do escape almost daily through Macau and work their way up to Hong Kong in the hope of finding work whereby they may buy food for their children and provide themselves a home. But there are literally hundreds of thousands of them who cannot be housed in any sort of housing in Hong Kong. And there I saw them at bedtime one night, going to bed, women sitting on the edge of the street, bathing their babies in wash pans, putting them to bed against the side of a store building right on the very sidewalk. I saw men and women, whole families lying there, going to bed for the night. And in the one little park area there, I saw men and boys sitting almost as close together as they could sit, there finding the only recreation, the only semblance of normal living that you could have in such a place. And when I looked at those hundreds of thousands of people and realized that we had no established mission work among them, the thought came to me, how can they be told of Jesus Christ? And I realized that we could never have enough missionaries to touch the lives of all those people, that if they're ever to hear the message of Jesus Christ, it must be through seminary education, sending out more and more missionaries to establish more and more opportunities for nationals to be trained and to minister and to witness and to preach to their own people. I was made aware of it again when we were over in Indonesia. The missionaries there had decided the best way for us to understand Indonesia was to drive through the country across the island of Java. And so we took 6 days to drive across that island. Now, it is the most crowded spot, I suppose, in all the world. 1,000 people live to every square mile of land on the island of Java. And so as we drove, there was never a moment when we were out of sight of people, neither by day nor by night. As you would turn a curve in the road, you would just see more people working in the rice fields, working in the canals, walking along the highways, carrying the burdens that you and I here see carried in trucks or by animals. And so it was difficult at times to even drive along the highway for the masses of people crowded into it. And one day as we were driving along, Dr. Kathleen Jones was driving the station wagon, and we were just working our way in and out among the people. And Dr. Jones said, "You know, when I drive among these people, I sometimes wonder if we really believe they are lost." And there was silence in the station wagon, and we all were acutely aware of the masses of people, the multitudes that we read about even in the Bible. And she broke the silence finally by saying, "I often conclude that Southern Baptists do not really believe they're lost, for if we did, we would do more to send the gospel to them." Now, you have to see the multitudes of that part of the world, the multitudes of people who live in the Orient without Christ, and the multitudes of people in Africa today, to realize the importance of seminary education, the importance of establishing schools where their own young men and young women can be trained to go out into the churches, into the communities, into the refugee sections, and there spread the gospel. And so my heart was warmed as I saw the degree to which the seminaries have been developed in countries where we have long had mission work. The seminary in Ogbomosho, Nigeria is a credit to any denomination, I should think. And I looked with pride at what was going on there as I was there for 2 or 3 days attending a mission meeting and saw not only the missionaries of that country, more than 200 of them gathered together there, but I saw the national Nigerian leaders who work with the missionaries in making the plans for that convention, and who hold positions of responsibility in the faculty and administrative group of that seminary. And as I looked at that seminary, it's a beautiful group of buildings, and I realized the influence of it in the country of Nigeria. I realized that here is the hope of evangelizing Nigeria in the years ahead, to have this seminary and perhaps others comparable to it in other parts of that country, to train the African people to witness to their own people. I was gratified when I visited the seminary in Japan, where we have had mission work now for 70 years, to see the degree to which that seminary program has developed. And it was thrilling to go into the churches of Japan, as well as into some of the institutions, and see the degree to which the Japanese people themselves are holding the positions of leadership in that convention. The preachers are Japanese. Many of the school administrators are Japanese. The principal of the president of the great school there at Fukuoka is a Japanese Christian gentleman of rare abilities. And so I felt that we were seeing in our day the results of the labors and the prayers of those who had gone before us in the mission endeavors in that country. In Taiwan, I was thrilled, as I was in Hong Kong, to visit the churches and see the Chinese pastors in positions of leadership. Chinese pastors preaching to churches filled with people. And I thought how wonderful it would be for those early missionaries who went out, the very first from our convention, to witness among the Chinese people. And even though we cannot today visit the part of the world in which they actually lived, many of the churches which I visited are really churches that were begun in China proper and were moved out as the people refugeed and came out to Hong Kong or even to the island of Taiwan. And so certainly the leadership among the Chinese people that I observed is leadership that was developed in the seminaries and in the educational institutions of China proper, and we can be justifiably proud of the quality of their leadership. I think nowhere did I see more able leaders in operation than among the Chinese people. They conduct a meeting beautifully. They plan well and carry out their plans well. And so when I saw them, I felt that with more of them trained to do what these today among their own are doing, we could have real hope for the salvation of the Chinese people through the ministry of their own people. And so this lovely, lovely seminary that has been built at Taiwan, though new to us, is not really a completely new work. For many of the people connected with it and many of the influences that brought it into being came out of our old work in China. And so we are grateful for the mission efforts in old areas. But what about these in the new? It does your heart good to visit a small beginning of a preacher's school, which is ultimately to be a seminary. We visited such a preacher's school in the new country of Ghana. We were having lunch with some missionaries there, and the man in the family said, "The preacher's school is in session today, and I would like for you to see it." And so we left the home before the lunch was served and went with him to see this preacher's school. It was a tiny little building, very tiny, standing out in the middle of a field all by itself. And when we went in, we saw an African teacher, a Nigerian teacher, standing at the front teaching. And in this little room, there were three just plain benches, no backs to them at all. And on each bench sat four men, 12 in all, in this class. Now, these men were of varying ages. There were several middle age or past, and others were younger men. And it was explained to us that these preachers have been called to preach. They have not been prepared or educated to do so, and they earn their livelihood in various ways, some farming, some doing other things. And this preacher's school has been established here, to which these men come on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And they study all day those days. Then they go home by foot or by bicycle back to the places where they live, some of them at some distance. And they work for their living on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And then on Sunday, they preach in these 12 churches. Well, we were greeted by this teacher, and the missionary interpreted for us as we gave them our greetings and told them how pleased we were to see them, a small number to be true, but preparing themselves to preach more effectively in the areas from which they had come. We did not want to disturb this class any longer than was necessary, and so we were quickly to leave the room we prepared to. And as we started out, a very fine-looking Negro sitting on the back bench said, "I would like to speak before you leave in behalf of the others of us here." So, of course, we paused. He had a wonderfully strong face. I wish you could see his face as I can visualize it now to understand just how we were touched by what he said. I think I have never had a person more sincere in his appearance and in what he was saying. Now, you must remember, in these parts of the world, people look upon age in a very different way from the way we here in the United States do. Instead of trying to hide one's age in that part of the world, you brag about your age, or you let everyone know just how old you are. And the older you are, the more respected you are. And so this young man, though, not aware of the background, perhaps of in which we had grown up, was standing speaking to us. And he said, "We would like to thank you, or through you, we would like to thank the people of the Southern Baptist Convention when you go back for giving us this opportunity to study here." It was a very moving thing to hear him express their gratitude for something that was so humble as was this little preacher's school. And he said, "We are grateful to Southern Baptists for making it possible for us to come here and study the Word of God that we might better preach it to our people on Sunday." And then he looked at us and was expressing a word of personal appreciation to us. And he said, "We know that you have the love of God in your hearts." And of course, that was very moving for a person to say that. And when it was interpreted to us, we looked at him and, as I say, we're definitely moved. And then he said, "For nothing but the love of God could cause you to come so far to see us at so great age." So you can imagine, for American women, we wondered at the first time if we had understood him correctly. But we realized that we looked just that ancient to that young man who was studying there in that preacher's school. But I left there that day thinking, from this small beginning of these 12 earnest men, there will no doubt develop someday a seminary here in this country of Ghana from which the people can go out into the churches and into the convention to build a great and mighty work there. We were in Gwelo in southern Rhodesia at the time of commencement at the seminary. We arrived in the afternoon and were told that that night our assignment was to attend the commencement exercises. And so we gathered into the little chapel. Now, it doesn't look at all like this chapel, let me assure you. It's a small, simple little chapel there in the seminary in Guelo. And we were right down on the front. And when the time came for this service to take place, we saw 19 women brought in line, just as though in a procession. And those women marched down and sat in reserved seats right at the front. And so I nudged the missionary next to me, and I said, "Who are they?" And she said, "They are the graduates' wives." And then the music started, and we all stood with in a very solemn mood, just as you would here, and the processional began. Now, I am sure that if I were to be here at your commencement time this year, that the lump in my throat couldn't be as big as it grew as I stood there and watched this processional in that seminary that day. For down the aisle came the missionaries that we have sent out there, for they still do not have nationals trained to take the positions of leadership there. We saw these missionaries who've carried such heavy loads, teaching, several subjects, each one, in order that this seminary can be carried on. And they came down the aisle with all the dignity that Dr. Staley and the members of this faculty and administration can come down the aisle when you have yours, and took their places here on this small platform. And behind them came these 19 men. Now, all the faculty and these men were robed in academic robes which they had made themselves. And I think that was one of the things that touched me so, was to realize that this is a part of beginning, a thing that you and I just take for granted. And so when these men were seated there, I saw before me the 19 men who were to receive diplomas. And as I learned more about them through the missionary who was sitting by me, my heart was so filled with gratitude for them. For many of them had come there without earlier education or preparatory work to really take seminary work, and they had had to study long. There was a man there who received his diploma that night who had worked 5 years for what they call the two-year diploma. There were two men there who had worked 4 years for the two-year diploma. And when I thought how hard they had been willing to work to get this degree of education to better prepare themselves for the Christian ministry, my heart was really filled with gratitude. "But what about these 19 women sitting over here?" I asked. And I learned that no man is able to receive a diploma from that seminary until his wife has studied at least 1 year. And so these 19 women sitting there had completed their year of study so that they could be helpful, that they could understand, that they could have enough training to carry the responsibility of a pastor's wife as their husbands went out to accept positions of responsibility in that area. And so my heart was filled with gratitude for them, for they had had to either leave children behind for a whole year, or they had had to come there in that community and establish homes, uprooting themselves from the places they knew as home and uprooting a family as well. And so I thought, what a great price those ministers pay to prepare themselves to teach. But when that commencement service was over, and I saw again those 19 men and their wives standing for their pictures to be taken, I thought what a wonderful step forward this was for the Baptist work in Southern Rhodesia, when 19 men with a degree of preparation would go out from that seminary to fill 19 pulpits. And oh, can't you see that in the years ahead, through the leadership of those 19 men, there will come other young men called of God to preach who can take their places in the seminary classes and can thus supply a ministry.